You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is John White. John is no stranger to KTEP, and it's that time of year, folks, believe it or not. The last time we had him here, we were talking about what to do to protect plants from the heat, but now it's we're getting ready for the holidays, and we're going to talk about holiday plants, but also how to select holiday produce and other stuff that you might need for those holiday meals. John, thank you for being with us here, John.
Thank you, Louis.
Now, as I was talking about the fact that, you know, it was not too long ago you were here talking about protecting your plants from the heat, as you and I know, El Paso has those kind of surprise weather things that people have to be aware of that as far as protecting their plants.
Right. I mean, you never know when a cold spell is going to move in through the area. You know, the worst thing for plants is to go from real warm to real, real cold real fast, because they can't adjust like humans can. So if, you know, this Indian summer type fall that we've been having with the beautiful weather, and then all of a sudden turns off real cold, it can be damaging to some plants. And again, depending on how cold, it can actually, you know, do some severe damage to some plants. So hopefully we will continue to cool off and gradually go into our, you know, cold weather of winter. But we sure don't want to have a, you know, big dip down into the teens real quick, because that'll really knock plants back. But there are things that people can do to protect their plants. So if you do have plants, you know, say out on the patio or the porch, and they're frost sensitive or not real cold tolerant, then there are some things you can do as far as you know, covering the plants. They sell some materials that are called row cover material that are frost blankets. And they'll give you about 5 or 6 degrees protection, maybe 8 degrees with some of the thicker material. And it helps to keep heat in. And they're lightweight to where they don't squash the plants down like a blanket or something. You throw a blanket over a plant, you know, you need to have some support on it, because the weight of the blanket will crush that plant down or break some limbs off of it. So you want to be careful with that. Any kind of heat sources, of course, will help if your plants are real, real tender. But you want to be cautious, you know, bringing, you know, electric heater out or anything like that, because of the electricity. And if there's rain predicted, moisture, anything like that, of course, you want to be very, very careful there. You know, light bulbs do give off heat, but it's the old incandescent ones. The new LEDs and stuff don't give off very much heat at all, so they don't work very well.
What does Indian summer mean?
Well, it means where you're just going into a period where, you know, we don't have any real frost, and it's, you know, kind of like a somewhat above normal or just very, very temperate, you know, temperatures going in the extended fall period. So just, you know, these 75-degree high days and, you know, 45, 50-degree lows, sometimes not even that low. And we had them for several weeks in a row there, and it's just beautiful. I mean, we've had fall color in some of the trees that we haven't had in many, many years. And it's just been that nice, gradual, you know, slowing down. And the trees and plants, you know, the little bit of cold at night, the 50 and 45 degrees is enough to tell them to shut down. Of course, the days are getting shorter, and so the plants can recognize that you know, things are going, but those 70, 75 degree days kind of keep telling them, yeah, you still got a little time to grow here, you know, so they don't quite completely shut down. So they go through this real nice, you know, transitional period of going into fall, and they just, you know, we've had beautiful color on the ornamental pears and the ash trees and the crepe myrtles, and just beautiful color. Even the mulberries, you know, everybody cusses and discusses mulberries, but they actually had some beautiful yellow foliage on the trees. And, you know, until we really get some cold, those leaves are going to hang on for a while.
Let's talk a little bit about some of that foliage, because some of that's something that you see a lot during this time of year, and especially in the Upper Valley, and that's mistletoe.
Right. Mistletoe is a parasitic plant, so it's feeding off of the plant that it's living on. And so it's taking nutrients away from that plant. And as the mistletoe grows and gets thicker on the plant, like some of the older cottonwoods, the cottonwoods are also aging. So their whole process is slowed down just because of aging. And, you know, the mistletoe competes with that plant as far as nutrient and water and some of the stored food that the tree has. The mistletoe's also taking advantage of that. So it's a gradual weakening of the host plant, and that's why parasitic plants are so bad for the host plant. They do live off of them and sustain themselves off of that host plant. And yes, mistletoe is people like to collect it during the holiday period here, and you know, some of the myths and stuff with it, but it is a parasitic plant. Birds spread it. There are several different species of trees that can be affected by it. Some of our ash trees that are in people's yards here are susceptible to mistletoe. And if you have a desirable tree in your yard that does get mistletoe, you want to have somebody come in and take the mistletoe out. And that may require taking that limb off that the mistletoe is attached to.
And you have to be careful, I would guess, because especially the trees here in the Upper Valley, that mistletoe is so high up there.
Right.
And as you mentioned, people collect it, sell it, because, you know, in some ways, it's almost like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, because it's a meanie when it comes to the trees. But then if you bring it down, you get a kiss from someone, allegedly.
Right.
So.
Right.
As far as collecting that and getting it down, does it have to be kept in a certain way to keep fresh, or does it die as soon as it's pulled from the tree?
It'll gradually die off and dry, but you know, if you cut it and keep it in an area that's fairly dark and cool, it'll last for quite a while. Some of the berries on it, which are poisonous, you have to be careful of. So when you're taking them off or bringing them in the house and you're dropping these berries off on the floor or the ground, and you want to make sure some of the pets or small children and stuff aren't picking these up and thinking they're cat food, dog food, or some kind of candy the child might pick up. So you want to be careful where you place them. And if, you know, any of the berries drop off, they need to be collected. And gradually the foliage will become crisp and, you know, be time to throw it out. But you probably don't have to worry about that till after the first of the year.
You know, it's interesting as you're talking about the good and the bad of holiday plants, because as you just mentioned, mistletoe is considered a parasitic plant and also a dangerous to pets. Did you not say that the poinsettia is also dangerous to pets?
Well, poinsettias, they're reported to be kind of like fatally poisonous, and some of that's been refuted, but they still will cause a pretty good stomach upset and stuff, depending on how much is eaten. But you really don't want to set your poinsettias where, you know, a cat or a dog's going to get into them. The white sap that's in it is you'll get an allergic reaction if you get it on your skin, especially a sensitive part of the skin. If you get it in the mouth, it'll cause some lesions and things on the inside of the mouth. But it's not as poisonous as what it was first reported, but still it's a plant that you want to be careful of and not have around if you've got a lot of young kids or pets that might get into it.
Now, you see a lot of them, and they vary in size, and some of them are huge, and of course, a lot of them come now in various colors as well. And, you know, some people who are, I guess, purists say, well, you know, that's not right. I think they should be the traditional color that they've always been, or they shouldn't be that big. They're genetically modified, etc. An expert on horticulture and agriculture, what would you say to that?
Well, I mean, to each their own. There are a lot of variations where, the guy I used to work with here at the museum, Wynn Anderson, would always call him the Frankenstein horticulturist out, you know, creating new plants and stuff. But a lot of the poinsettias, as well as other plants now, are grown by tissue culture. And so they'll take a little piece of tissue, you know, a few cells off of a plant and grow them out, and they can make identical plants by the millions. You know, so it's a very quick way to reproduce plants, and you get identical plants. Now, purists would say that's cloning, and, you know, religiously, some people might say that's not good, and purists will say it's not good because you're not allowing nature to take place. You're in there reproducing, but as a businessman, you want, you know, if people want red poinsettias, then you want every one of them to be red, and that's an economical way to reproduce them. So you kind of hear both sides of the coin on it. I traditionally like the red poinsettia. That to me is you know, the holiday season with a red poinsettia, but they do have pink ones and white ones, and then they can run some dyes through them and get different colors and variations and speckles and all kinds of stuff. And the actual colored part is not the flower, but actually the bract. It's a modified leaf on the plant, and the flower is actually the little yellow thing down in the center of where all the color is. And so, again, the plant breeders and stuff have done something with the sizes of the bracts and how long they last. Poinsettias now almost last all year round, whereas back in the old days, you know, the poinsettia pretty much played itself out, and then you had to go through this ritual of putting it in dark, and, you know, put it in the closet and keep it in there and move it, you know, and do all that. And now they're, you know, so relatively inexpensive that you basically, you know, when you're through with the poinsettia, you just throw it away and buy a new one next year. You don't try and keep them going and going.
And that moves us on now to the Christmas cactus. And some of those people do try and, right, and keep them all year. And I think you said that sometimes you can fool them, but they are very hard to keep alive year-round.
Right. Traditionally, the Christmas cactus is called that because if you didn't do anything just with the shortening of the days and all that, it will trigger that plant into bloom if it's allowed to have, you know, natural light, so that it knows it's going through that process. If not, it's artificially done through, you know, light regimes and dark regimes, so giving the plant darkness and then light, and you can trick it into blooming. But Christmas cactus is a plant that you actually have, you know, like plant societies that actually, you know, have get-togethers with other Christmas cactus growers, and they pass pieces around and, you know, do a little bit of modification, hybridizing on them. But it is a, you know, pretty much a true plant that will last a long time. I knew a lady in Albuquerque that had one that was passed down by her mother, I believe, mother or grandmother, and this lady was in her 70s. And so that plant was over 70 years old. And so it was, you know, still blooming and still growing good. And, you know, so they will last a long time if they're taken care of. And so, you know, the poinsettias are a little different. They're, you know, you can keep them going, but they can also be just tossed and treated as an annual and buy a new one next year.
And we talked about some people being purist, and of course the traditions, and everybody has different holiday traditions, and some people in fact won't even put up a Christmas tree until Christmas Eve. That's the tradition, and those are traditions that were used in the old days, in the days of the old West. Also, they'd go out and chop that tree and put it up on Christmas Eve. However, now you know, through the work of some miraculous fertilizer, all of a sudden, these parking lots sprout all these Christmas trees, you know. And yes, so people go out there and choose. And some people buy them too early or wait till the last. What should people do as far as those trees? First of all, the ones they buy out in the parking lots. And then also, if they're going to get a live tree that they plan to plant later.
Well, on Christmas trees, you know, unfortunately, I mean, we do have some Christmas tree growers in the state of Texas. You know, there's some in New Mexico, but unfortunately, none of them are near El Paso. So a lot of the plant material comes from quite a distance. And so those plants are harvested usually before Thanksgiving, and they just gradually make their way into El Paso after being cut for 2 or 3 weeks already. And so the problem is trying to find a fresh tree. So, you know, hopefully having trust in whoever your Christmas tree salesperson is, that they will tell you how long the trees have been cut for. But the, you know, the sooner you can get the harvest date as to, you know, when you buy it, you're going to have a fresher tree. Then you can look at how the tree's been kept, how it's been stored and taken care of, you know, if it's been in water or if they've just been laying out in the parking lot and not receiving any water. Those plants are beginning to dry out. And there is a trick where some Christmas tree growers will spray a kind of like an antitranspirant on the tree with a little bit of dye in it that gives it a little bit of a, I call it a kind of an artificial green color, but sometimes you'll actually see some of the dye on the bark of the tree and stuff like that, so you'll know it's been sprayed so that it has an artificial color to it, because the tree's probably beginning to yellow, and then the antitranspirant helps to keep moisture in the needles so that the tree stays fresher a little bit longer. But ideally, you like to get a tree that's been freshly harvested and, you know, something that's been stored in water. And, of course, when you buy a tree, you want to make a fresh cut on the bottom of the tree and stick it in water immediately so that, you know, if it's got a fresh cut on it, hopefully it'll begin to take some water up into the tree. But having the tree inside, some people, you know, as you're mentioning, like to put a tree up shortly after Thanksgiving and then keep it all the way to Christmas or New Year's. And keeping the tree in the house at, you know, 75 degrees, it takes its toll on the tree. It uses huge amounts of water. And if you aren't freshly adding water to the basin, then that tree will begin to shed needles and start to dry on you, and then it needs to be pulled.
If indeed it is a live tree, John, and people are expecting to plant it, how soon should they do that?
A live tree, on the other hand, if you bring it inside and then keep it again for 3 or 4 weeks in the house at 70, 75 degrees, and no freezing temperature, that tree is going to think it's time to grow again, and the tree will actually start to put growth on. And then if you take it outside, and, you know, we happen to be down in the teens or the 20s, you're liable to get some cold damage on that tree, even though it might be cold, you know, tolerant, but just because it'd been kept in the house and then you're immediately taking it outside to freezing weather, it just will do damage on it. So a living Christmas tree, you don't want to keep in the house more than probably 2 weeks at the max.
Latest talk now is, you know, you hear about people wanting to buy organic type foods, organic fruits. And some people might wonder, okay, if I do buy, let's say, pomegranates or nuts or whatever for type of holiday snacks or to decorate my house, what do I need to look out for?
If you're buying you know, produce, they, you know, there is a move afoot nationwide to go to product origin on a lot of our foodstuffs so that you know exactly where it comes from. And, you know, some of the cases they've had where they've had food poisoning problems, you know, luckily we've had enough stuff in the system where it can be tracked from purchase at the store all the way back to where it was grown. So we're lucky to have that system in place to where a lot of times that can be traced back. And then, you know, trying to find out where the site of contamination is or how things happen, that's, you know, another part of the tricky thing. But they would like to see labeling on produce right at the grocery store. So if you pick up that apple, you can look at it and it'll have a label saying that it was from the United States or it was from Colombia or Peru or Bolivia or wherever, you know, it might be from. So they're trying to get that implemented. You know, unfortunately, I've got some friends with USDA and stuff, and with budget cuts, a lot of the food inspector type positions are being cut. And so the people on the bridge that do plant inspections, the, you know, health inspectors, the plant inspectors, you know, all that is being, you know, dwindled back, cut back. So we're losing some of those positions. And so, you know, they're, you know, this is just my opinion, but there could be, you know, more incidents of contamination just because it's getting overlooked. There's not enough people to check everything. And organic, anything sold as organic has to be, that grower has to be in a program with USDA, has signed up and, you know, paid. And if they don't have that, they're not supposed to use the word organic. So sometimes you'll see at a farmer's market where somebody's selling natural grown or pesticide free, stuff like that. Those aren't necessarily government mandated terms. That's the term they're using, but they use organic. That is under a USDA federal government program to where the person's supposed to abide by a certain set of rules and regulations as far as growing that crop and being able to sell it as an organic product.
And as you mentioned, because of budget cuts and because of monies, sometimes these local farmers, I mean, they do have natural fruits and vegetables. They do have natural nuts, whatever they're growing, but they don't have the monies to apply for these programs and to certify them as organic, so they can't sell them like that.
Yeah, and part of it is, you know, your marketing program. If you're marketing locally, they may not necessarily have to be organic, but if you're going to sell your products to, say, one of the big box stores, chain stores, you know, things like that, then that store may require those products to be under the organic certification program.
For a while there, New Mexico was one of the top pecan growing states in the area. That's not the case anymore?
No, it's still one of the top. I can't remember if they were number two or number three last year. But they are one of the, and the acreage, of course, has increased. Arizona is increasing their acreage. So there is a lot more pecans. And, of course, there's a lot of controversy about the water use on pecans and, you know, this and that. But as far as local farmers, this drought is causing a lot of problems, you know, with the food supply. You know, a lot of the, in this, drought is wide-ranging. It's not just right here in El Paso. It's not just in Las Cruces. It encompasses a big area. And, you know, some of the food-growing areas, even outside of the state of Texas and or out of, you know, the state of New Mexico, they're having temperature fluctuations and all this stuff too. And it's really creating a lot of problems. But drought is widespread, it's long-lasting, and there's people that are going out of business due to the drought. Their pumps have gone dry. They're having to shut farms down. They're not growing as much product. And so, you know, somewhere along the line here, we're going to see that in prices at the grocery store, and you may not be seeing as much at farmers market because people – you know, we don't have the rainfall to support it. They aren't getting the allotments through the irrigation district because there's no water in the dam north of town. So, if you know, unless you have wells and have some kind of irrigation system, you know, they aren't going to be growing produce. So, you know, I would expect to see some loss of some of your farmers market people that you've, you know, maybe relied on for a while because of the drought.
John, because of where we live, of course, we miss out on a lot of holiday traditions. And, you know, I was asked the other day by someone, a child, I don't remember who it was, but they'd been reading a book and about the, you know, people selling hot roasted chestnuts out on the street. And so they're wondering if they could buy those here in El Paso and what do they taste like. And I said, I don't know. I don't know if they sell
hot roasted chestnuts. Chestnuts aren't grown anywhere close to El Paso. So you aren't going to find hot roasted chestnuts. You might be able to find roasted pecans or pistachios or something like that. But, you know, we do have a lot of food handling laws and regulations that, you know, I know some of the produce people used to cut up, you know, watermelon to have pieces for sampling. And a lot of that falls under scrutiny of the food police now. A lot of that's not allowed, and you know, because you do have it out in the open, and it can be handled, and you know, there's a lot of issues there. So a lot of times you won't see that as much. You know, there is somebody I know at the farmer's market in Cruces that sells roasted almonds, and the almonds aren't local because we have no almond orchards nearby, but they do buy the almonds, bring them in, and they roast them and you know heat them up and salt them and, you know, things there, you know, at the booth, so you can buy them that way. Pecans I haven't seen done at a farmer's market or anything, but, of course, there's different pecan shops that will sell.
They sell those.
Roasted and green chili and caramel and chocolate covered and, you know, all those different kind. You know, there are some local pecan growers that are big enough. They do have some outlets. They may not have all the variation in candies and, you know, chocolate-covered stuff, but you can buy pecans and, again, look at, you know, some of the ads in the Thrifty Nickel and, you know, papers and stuff and drive up and down the valley. You'll find people that have, and this is the time when they're harvesting, so you'll see all the plumes of dust in the valley, and they're all busy harvesting right now, so now's the time to go out and start looking.
Well, John, thank you very much for sharing your knowledge with us today. And
thank you, Lee.
You have questions about some of the things that John was talking about, I know that the Pecan Growers Association, the Peanut Growers Association, a lot of those associations also have websites, and then you can find specific recipes, holiday recipes, so you might want to look into that. We've been visiting with John White, and John is the curator of the Chihuahuan Deserts Gardens across the street here at the Centennial Museum, and he was giving us a little bit of holiday tips before we go out and buy our Christmas teas and other holiday plants. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Lou.
If you have a topic that you'd like Louis Saenz and his team of experts to pursue for Perspectives, you can reach us by coming to our website, ktep.org, click on the Contact Us button, leave your comments and suggestions, and make sure they go to Louis Saenz in care of Perspectives. A production of KTEP, all rights reserved, 2012 by the University of Texas at El Paso and KTEP.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Saenz.